On a frigid December evening in 1975, the Lutz family, a hopeful couple and their three young children, stepped into an elegant Dutch colonial home on Ocean Avenue, eager to begin a new chapter. They had no idea that this house, so close to a peaceful canal and yet marked by unspeakable tragedy, would bend reality itself around them. The dog whimpered at cold spots. Invisible fingers brushed the children's ears at night, and spectral whispers echoed through empty halls. Doors slammed with savage force. Shadows twitched in corners. A priest called back, frantic and shaken after a blessing, claiming something had spat threats at him. Within 4 weeks, their world fractured. They left everything behind, terrified. No one has fully explained what happened, and neither has the house. So if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform and leave us a comment, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. Chapter 1. Ocean Avenue's Terrible Secret. The day George and Kathy Lutz signed the papers, it felt like a blessing. The house at 112 Ocean Avenue was too good to be true. A sprawling Dutch colonial with a boathouse, three stories, and a finished basement, all for just $80,000. Kathy's eyes sparkled when she first walked through the arched front door. The kids, Daniel, Christopher, and Missy, were already chasing each other through the halls. It had space, charm, and character. But what George couldn't stop thinking about was the price. It was a steal, and everyone knows you don't steal a house that nice without something being very wrong. The realtor hesitated before handing over the keys. "There's something you should know." Kathy and George exchanged a glance. "The DeFeo murders," the realtor said flatly. "It happened here, a year ago." Kathy stiffened. George blinked. "Murders?" "Yes. Ronald DeFeo Jr. shot his parents and four siblings in their beds, all six of them. Middle of the night. No one heard a thing. He claims voices told him to do it." Silence. "But you're not required to disclose that unless asked," she added quickly. "You asked." Kathy looked at George. He looked back. "We're not superstitious," Kathy said with a shrug. George forced a smile. "We're getting a..." "Showed the house at night. Every window dark, except for one. Missy's. And in that window, two red circles. Watching." Kathy felt a knot tighten in her chest. "Missy," she asked gently, "who is Jody?" Her daughter smiled. "She protects me. She likes me." "Where does she come from?" "She lives in the house. She was here before us." Kathy hesitated. "What does she say to you?" Missy's face changed. Her smile dropped. "She says Mommy's going to die." That night, George finally admitted something he'd been hiding. He'd seen the eyes too, outside Missy's window, glowing, watching. The dog had barked furiously, and when George ran outside with a flashlight, the eyes disappeared, but hoofprints remained. Deep, perfect imprints in the snow. Not paw prints, not boots, hooves. And they led nowhere. Just vanished in the middle of the yard. That was the night George started locking all the windows, even on the second floor, even during the day. They tried ignoring Jody, forbidding Missy from talking to her. It made things worse. Missy stopped eating. She grew pale and quiet. She spoke only in whispers. Then came the shrieking. Missy would wake in the middle of the night, screaming as if something were sitting on her chest. One night, she clawed at her own neck, claiming Jody told her she had to let the bad out. Kathy cradled her daughter in tears. "Jody's hurting you," she whispered. Missy shook her head violently. "No, you don't understand. She's scared. She says the Red Room is waking up." George dug deeper into the house's history. He visited the Amityville Historical Society. The DeFeo murders were well known. Ronald DeFeo Jr. had slaughtered his entire family in their beds, then calmly went to work the next day. But something wasn't sitting right with George. He asked about the land before the DeFeos. A librarian hesitated, then slid him a dusty folder. The land, it turned out, had a history long before any house was built. A history tied to the Shinnecock tribe. Tribal records hinted the area was used as a kind of asylum for the mentally disturbed, the sick, and the violent. A place to isolate those who couldn't be cleansed. Some called it the sick ground, a place where dark spirits were believed to linger long after death. George stared at the final page, in the folder. A translated tribal phrase, "Do not build where the earth remembers." He closed the folder and left. The next day, Missy went missing. The house was quiet. Too quiet. Kathy noticed it first. No footsteps upstairs, no toys being dragged across the floor, no humming. Missy? Silence. Panic surged through her. She searched every room, bathroom, closet, attic, nothing. Then she heard the laugh, low, wet, coming from the basement. She ran down, heart pounding. The red room door was open. Inside, Missy, sitting cross-legged, eyes closed, chanting. Around her were toys, laid in a circle. Kathy ran in and pulled her out. "What are you doing?" Missy looked up, eyes wide. "She was showing me where she died." That night, Kathy asked George if he believed in demons. He didn't answer at first. He just stared into the fire. "I believe something wants her," he finally said. "She's just a little girl," Kathy whispered. "That's why it's using Jody." Missy refused to sleep alone after that. She spoke of tunnels beneath the house, of rooms that weren't there before, of Jody showing her where the others went. Kathy begged her to stop talking like that, but Missy looked up and said, "Jody says you're not strong enough to protect us." Desperate, Kathy called a local priest unaffiliated with the diocese, a man who specialized in spiritual trauma. He agreed to visit. The moment he entered the house, he froze. "There's something ancient here," he said. "Something that was summoned, maybe not by the DeFios, maybe even earlier." He asked to speak to Missy. When he did, she asked one question. "Do you hear them too?" The priest's face went pale. He conducted a brief cleansing ritual in Missy's room. The lights flickered. The door slammed shut behind him. When he exited, he was trembling. "You have to leave," he said, "immediately." That night, Missy slept in Kathy's bed. George stayed downstairs, sharpening the axe again. At 3:15 a.m., Missy sat up. "Jody says she'll miss me." Kathy sat up too. "Where is Jody now?" Missy pointed to the closet. Kathy turned to look. The door was slowly opening, empty, except for two red dots in the dark. Kathy screamed. George ran in, swinging. But by then, the dots were gone. They left the house 3 days later. Missy never spoke of Jody again, but Kathy kept one of her drawings. It was the house again, same window, same red eyes, only this time the house was burning. And in the flames, Jody smiled. Chapter 5, The Final Night. It was January 14th, 1976, the last night the Lutz family would ever spend inside 112 Ocean Avenue. They didn't know it yet, not for sure. But something had shifted, something irreversible. For weeks, they had endured the shadows, the voices, the nightmares, and the slow unraveling of their sanity. But that final night, the house stopped whispering. It roared. George hadn't slept in days. He was pacing again, shirtless despite the bitter cold. His eyes looked feral. He kept muttering under his breath, repeating the same phrase, "Don't let it take her. Don't let it take her." Kathy tried to comfort him, but he pulled away, sweat slicking his skin. "You don't understand," he hissed. "It doesn't want me anymore. It wants Missy." Kathy froze. She had felt the same. Their daughter had become the center of something, something ancient, something watching, and now something was preparing to claim her. Around 1:30 a.m., the temperature dropped sharply. Frost crept up the inside of the windows. Water in the toilets froze solid. The fire went out, on its own. The logs still sat there, untouched. George shoved new logs in, struck a match. Nothing. The flame sparked and died. He stared at the hearth. Then a gust of wind roared through the living room, inside the sealed house. The fire roared back to life, and the walls began to breathe. Kathy woke to Missy screaming. She bolted down the hallway, nearly slipping on the icy floorboards. George was already in Missy's room, holding her as she sobbed. "She was here," Missy cried. "Jody was here. She said it's time." "Time for what?" Kathy asked. "To stay," Missy whimpered. "To stay with her, in the red room." That's when the house came alive. The doors blew open, cabinet doors slammed. The crucifix in the hallway spun on its nail and shot across the room, embedding in the wall like a knife. Christopher and Daniel screamed from their rooms. Their beds were shaking. The window panes cracked, one by one. Kathy ran to gather them as George grabbed the axe from downstairs. He was ready to fight something he couldn't see. In the kitchen, the walls began to bleed again. Thick, black-red sludge poured from the outlets, dripping to the tile floor. The refrigerator door flew open, hurling glass bottles across the room. A deep, growling voice filled the house. Not from one place, but from everywhere at once. "You were warned. Now she stays." George raised the axe and shouted into the air, "You can't have her!" The floor beneath him split. He jumped back as a crack zigzagged across the tiles, leading straight to the basement. The red room door was open again. Only now, something stood inside it. Kathy saw it first. A dark figure, tall, genderless, motionless, its face blank, skin like ash, eyes like flame. Missy cried, "Jody?" But the figure didn't move. It just stared. Then it raised one long, crooked finger, pointing at Missy. George stepped in front of her. "No," he said. The figure opened its mouth and screamed. The sound tore through the house like a sonic wave. Every light bulb exploded. The chandelier crashed. The paintings ripped themselves off the walls. The children covered their ears, sobbing. George dropped the axe and fell to his knees, nose bleeding. Kathy pulled her children into a closet, slamming the door shut. In the darkness, she could hear George yelling, and something else, not screaming, laughing. Minutes passed, or maybe hours. When the noise finally stopped, she opened the door. George was slumped at the bottom of the stairs, alive, barely. His eyes met hers. "We have to go, now." They didn't pack. They didn't dress the children. They ran barefoot through the snow, Missy in Kathy's arms, Daniel and Christopher trailing behind. They drove to Kathy's mother's house, 30 miles away. George didn't speak the entire drive. Later that day, Kathy asked him what happened when the figure screamed. George looked at her and said nothing. But that night, she found him burning his clothes in the backyard. They never went back, not to the house, not for the furniture, not even for the photos on the walls. For months, George would wake at 3:15 a.m., even in a new house. Kathy kept seeing shadows out of the corner of her eye, and Missy. Missy never spoke of Jody again, but sometimes she still drew. One picture showed the house, burning, the same red eyes in the window, and something else, a family inside. Only Missy was drawn standing outside, watching, smiling. Chapter 6, Aftermath and Possession. They escaped the house, but the house didn't let them go. For weeks after fleeing 112 Ocean Avenue, the Lutz family tried to rebuild a sense of normalcy in Kathy's mother's small, one-story home in Deer Park. But something dark had followed them, something unseen, something that didn't need walls to hold power. The first sign came 3 nights later. George woke again at 3:15 a.m., bolt upright, drenched in sweat, heart pounding like a war drum. The room was quiet, still, but he felt it, that pressure on his chest, that coldness in his bones. He sat up, walked to the bathroom, splashed cold water on his face. When he looked up into the mirror, there was a handprint, a child's, on the glass behind him. No one else was awake. Kathy began losing time. She'd be folding laundry or cooking, and suddenly realized an hour had passed, with no memory of what she'd done. Once, she found herself standing outside in the driveway, barefoot, holding a knife. She didn't know how long she'd been there. The kids were silent, withdrawn. Christopher stopped eating. Daniel had nightmares every night, screaming about the red faces in the floor. Missy, once glued to her stuffed animals, now only clutched a single object, a piece of charred wood she said came from under the stairs. The family agreed to speak to a paranormal investigator, this time someone seasoned in post-possession cleansing. Dr. Mary Evans was a psychologist who specialized in hauntings tied to trauma. She met the Lutzes at a church hall, neutral ground. She asked them to describe their experiences. George was reluctant. Kathy spoke in a hushed tone, as if the house could still hear her. When they finished, Dr. Evans said something none of them expected. You're not haunted by a spirit. You're carrying a residue. That house was a conductor. It opens something in each of you, and it doesn't close easily. She suggested a spiritual detox process. 7 days of prayer, fasting, and separation. No mirrors, no religious symbols unless personally significant. No discussing the events allowed during the process. It helped at first. The dreams stopped. George smiled again. Kathy cooked. The children played. But on the sixth night, George disappeared. Kathy woke alone in bed. The front door was open. She found him in the woods behind the house, kneeling in the dirt, hands muddy, eyes wide. He had dug a shallow hole. Inside it, the charred wood from the house, his wedding ring, and a single crayon drawing, one of Missy's, of the Red Room. They moved again, this time out of state, to California. New house, new jobs, new start. But reporters followed. Word had leaked about their story. A best-selling book was being negotiated. A movie deal. Suddenly, their haunting became entertainment. People accused them of lying, of making it all up for fame, of faking it. Kathy cried the first time she read a newspaper headline that called them opportunists. "They think we wanted this," she said to George. "Do they think we wanted to live with the devil?" George didn't answer. He was staring at the ceiling. Missy started drawing Jody again. Only now, Jody looked different. Larger, hungrier. Not a pig anymore, but a shadow with wings. "Why is she back?" Kathy asked gently. Missy shrugged. "She says it's because Daddy never said goodbye." That night, George agreed to return to the house one final time. Not to stay. Not to collect belongings. Just to close the chapter. He brought a Bible. A crucifix. A tape recorder. He walked through the house alone, while a paranormal team monitored from outside. When he reached the basement, the tape recorder caught something chilling. First, silence. Then, George's voice saying, "I don't fear you anymore." Then, static. And then, "But we still remember you." The tape cut off there. George emerged pale and silent. He never spoke of what he saw inside. Kathy said he was never the same afterward. His health declined. He suffered from night terrors. Sometimes, he'd wake up and just stare into the corner of the room, unmoving, for hours. In 1980, the film The Amityville Horror was released. The world consumed their trauma as fiction. To this day, people debate whether the Lutz story was real, but Kathy never wavered. "Something happened in that house," she said during a rare interview. "Whether you believe us or not, we survived it." George died in 2006. Kathy died 2 years earlier. They never divorced. Never truly recovered. And Missy? She changed her name, moved far away, declined all interviews. But a reporter once tracked her down. She wouldn't speak about the house, but she allowed one photo. It was her front porch. On it, hung above the door, was a wooden sign. 3 words. "We got out." Chapter 7. What the house still hides. The house at 112. Ocean Avenue still stands, white painted with black shutters, its iconic quarter moon windows staring blankly toward the river. The eye windows, as they're now known to paranormal enthusiasts. The home has been sold, renovated, renamed, and even renumbered to discourage tourists. But those who've lived there after the Lutz family say one thing in unison. It never really feels like home. In the decades since the Lutzes fled that January night in 1976, investigators, skeptics, authors, filmmakers, and self-proclaimed ghost hunters have all descended on the house. Some left with nothing but old dust and warped floorboards, others left shaken. One real estate agent claimed her keys wouldn't turn in the front lock until she said, "Let me in." Another homeowner, who lived there in the late 1980s, said his daughter had an imaginary friend named Rhea, who described being buried behind the red wall. The child had never heard the Lutz story. The parents moved out within 6 months. The red room, still there, still sealed behind drywall. In 2002, a construction crew working on basement repairs unearthed something unexpected. Behind a loose brick near the foundation, they found a cavity containing a small bundle, 3 yellowed photographs, a rusted toy car, and a child's shoe. No explanation, no identifying marks. but one of the photos showed two boys, smiling. One of them was unmistakably Mark DeFeo, one of the murdered children. The other boy, still unidentified. The image was turned over to the Amityville Historical Society. It was never seen again. The priest who once blessed the house, Father Mancuso, retired in silence. After multiple health scares and psychiatric evaluations, he declined all further media requests. But in a private note uncovered after his death in 2015, he had written, "That house was not cursed by the murders. The murders were a symptom of something that was already awake." In 1995, a team of psychic researchers spent 72 hours in the home with infrared cameras, EVP equipment, and motion sensors. They reported nothing during their stay, but three members of the crew died in separate incidents within the following year, one from a car crash, one from suicide, and one from an undiagnosed aneurysm. The footage never released. The tapes were said to have been corrupted. The Lutz family remained adamant until their deaths that they did not fabricate their story. George once said in a late interview, "You think we wanted this kind of attention? We were mocked, stalked, and broken by what we experienced. That house didn't need us to believe in it. It just needed us to walk through the front door." To this day, believers say the house was built on sacred land, once used by native tribes as a burial site. Skeptics call that urban legend. But ground scans done in 2001 revealed underground cavities beneath the home, tunnels, chambers, voids that shouldn't exist. Experts dismiss them as old water channels. No one has excavated, and no one has volunteered to. Missy Lutz, now living under a new identity, has never returned to Amityville. But in 2021, an anonymous blog post under the username NotJody shared a chilling account. "I used to have dreams of a hallway with red walls. I'd walk and walk, but the end never came. Just a door. And behind that door, someone waited for me. I never opened it. Until one night, I did, and I saw myself. Still 5 years old, still holding a stuffed animal, still smiling." The post ended with a single sentence. "Some houses never stop calling you home." The current owners of 112 Ocean Avenue have repainted, remodeled, and denied all rumors of paranormal activity. They say it's just an old house with an unfortunate past. And maybe they're right. Maybe the house sleeps now, waiting. Or maybe it only needed the Lutz family. Maybe it only ever needed one thing to be remembered. Mansion for the price of a shack. They signed the papers that afternoon. The first few nights were quiet, maybe too quiet. But moving into a new home, especially one with such dark history, always comes with tension. Boxes were unpacked, curtains hung, furniture rearranged. George brought his tools out to the garage to set up his workspace. The kids picked their rooms. Kathy hung a crucifix in the master bedroom. But as dusk fell on the third night, things began to shift. It started small. Light flickers, distant knocking that seemed to come from within the walls. George began waking every morning at exactly 3:15 a.m., drenched in sweat. He couldn't explain why, but he felt compelled to get out of bed and roam the house. He'd check the doors, the windows, the locks. Once he even walked into the basement without remembering why. Kathy's dreams turned vivid and disturbing. She'd wake in the middle of the night screaming, her heart pounding. She couldn't remember the details, only flashes. A young girl's eyes wide with fear, a red room, a scream muffled by water. Even the dog started acting strange. Harry, their black Labrador, began whining at the basement door. He'd growl low, ears flat, body rigid. Once, he refused to go downstairs entirely, snapping at George when he tried to tug him along. Still, they chalked it up to nerves. Until the priest came. Father Mancuso arrived on the fifth day to bless the house. He was an old friend of Kathy's family and agreed to perform a traditional house blessing to clear the air. It didn't go as planned. As soon as he stepped inside, a wave of nausea hit him. He described the sensation as walking into a thundercloud. His skin crawled. He tried to shake it off and went upstairs, rosary in hand, to begin the blessing. He reached the second floor bedroom that once belonged to the murdered DeFeo boys. He opened the door and heard a voice. It was low, male, and guttural. "Get out." He turned around. No one there. Thinking he imagined it, he resumed the prayer. "Get out." This time, it came with a rush of cold air and a stinging sensation across his face. He stumbled out of the room, disoriented and trembling. He never finished the blessing. He left without saying goodbye. That night, he developed a high fever and severe blisters on his hands, like burns. He told George over the phone, "Don't go into that room ever again." George hung up and stared at the second floor, now cloaked in shadow. Things deteriorated quickly after that. George changed. He became withdrawn, irritable, obsessed with the fireplace. No matter how hot it was, he claimed the house felt cold. He chopped wood every day, refusing to leave the fire unattended. His beard grew out. He stopped going to work. His eyes had a glazed, distant look. Kathy felt it too. She began hearing footsteps when she was alone, voices murmuring behind doors. One day she walked past the bathroom mirror and saw a woman's face behind her that vanished the moment she turned around. The crucifix in the master bedroom turned upside down. Daniel and Christopher started fighting more. Daniel claimed someone was waking him up at night, someone whispering in his ear. Missy became attached to an imaginary friend she called Jody, who she said was a pig with glowing red eyes that sat outside her window. George laughed at first, until he saw those eyes himself. Outside Missy's window, in the dark, were two red dots staring back. When he ran outside with a flashlight, there was nothing, except hoofprints, in the snow, leading away from the house. A week later, the walls began to bleed, literally. A dark, sticky ooze started leaking from the keyholes, running down the doors. Kathy tried to clean it. George watched silently. "It smells like death," she said. They found the red room in the basement a day later, a small hidden chamber behind a shelf. It hadn't been on the blueprints. The walls were painted deep crimson. No windows, no explanation. George couldn't breathe when he entered it. Neither could Kathy. The dog refused to go near it. They called a paranormal investigator, but they never made it inside. Their equipment failed the moment they pulled into the driveway. One of them vomited on the lawn. At night, the house shook. Doors slammed. Windows flew open. The children screamed in their sleep. Missy levitated off her bed. George saw it with his own eyes. "Something wants us gone," Kathy whispered, holding the kids close. George nodded. "Or worse, something wants us to stay." By the 28th night, the family couldn't take it anymore. They fled the house at 3 a.m., leaving everything behind, clothes, furniture, food still on the table. They never went back, not even to collect their belongings. The next owners found the home untouched, as if the family had simply vanished in the middle of dinner. The Lutzes never gave a full explanation, only fragments. The priest refused to discuss it. The house still stands, empty now. But if you listen closely on a quiet winter night, you can still hear the whisper, "Get out." Chapter 2. Voices in the Walls. The Lutz family had barely unpacked when the whispering began. At first, it was subtle, just a rustle, like wind sneaking through an old vent. But then it turned rhythmic, deliberate, like breath. And then, words. Words that didn't come from any one direction, but seemed to wrap themselves around the room. "George," he snapped upright in bed. Kathy was asleep beside him, her chest rising and falling peacefully. "George." He turned on the light. Nothing. He got up, checked on the children. All three were sound asleep. Daniel clutched his toy truck. Christopher was tangled in blankets. Missy's arm was draped around a stuffed bear. Everything looked normal, until George saw the rocking chair. It was swaying, just slightly, like someone had just stood up from it. The next morning, George said nothing. Neither did Kathy. They were both shaken, both pretending the other didn't notice the growing weight in the house. They cooked breakfast. The kids ate cereal and chattered about cartoons. But under the surface, the fear hummed quietly. That night, Kathy finally spoke. "I heard something." George looked up. "A voice," she whispered. "It was right next to me. I thought it was you at first." He didn't respond right away. "What did it say?" She paused. "It said my name, just my name." They sat in silence for a long moment. Then Kathy added, "And the mirror, I swear it rippled, like water." George tried to rationalize it. He had to. Maybe it was stress. They had taken on a new mortgage, a new home, new responsibilities. Kathy had 3 children from her previous marriage. He was trying to be the man of the house, hold everything together. But something about the house made it impossible to relax. Even when it was silent, it felt like something was always listening. The temperature dropped again that night, unnaturally cold. George chopped wood into the early hours, obsessively feeding the fireplace. When he finally laid down, it was nearly 3 a.m., and that's when the whispers came back. Only this time, it wasn't just his name. He won't protect them. She knows. Let us in. The voices poured from the walls, soft and echoing. George shot out of bed, flashlight in hand. He ripped open the closet. Nothing. He tore open the attic. Nothing. The basement, the crawl spaces, the vents. Empty. But the whispering followed him wherever he went. He didn't sleep that night. Kathy began recording their experiences in a small leather journal. She wasn't sure why. Maybe it helped her feel sane. Maybe it was proof for when someone inevitably called her delusional. Page after page filled up with cryptic observations. Closet door swung open by itself again. No draft. Cross in the kitchen now hanging upside down. No one touched it. Missy says Jody told her George will hurt us. I had a dream I drowned. Couldn't breathe. George found the journal one afternoon and read every word. He didn't speak to Kathy about it, but that night he began hearing something new in the house. Children's laughter. Not the kind that made you smile. Not playful or innocent. It was hollow, cold, a laugh that didn't belong to his children. Missy had grown more withdrawn. She talked to Jody for hours, often alone in her room. Kathy overheard her one day. Do you like my family? Pause. They're nice, except when Daddy gets mad. Pause. Jody says Daddy doesn't like you, Mommy. Kathy stepped into the room. Sweetheart, who's Jody? Missy pointed to the window. Kathy looked, nothing but the snowy backyard. She was just there, Missy said. She doesn't like when you interrupt. That night, George sat by the fire, silent. He hadn't spoken much in days. He barely ate. His skin looked pale, ashy. His eyes were sunken. Are you okay? Kathy asked gently. He looked at her. They talked to me too. Her blood ran cold. Desperation set in. They called a local psychic team, reluctantly, quietly. George didn't want the neighbors knowing. He still had his pride, even if the house was devouring it. The team arrived with gear, tape recorders, EMF, seam, detectors, cameras. One woman walked in and immediately began shaking. There's something angry here, she whispered. It's old. It doesn't want you. Another medium claimed the energy was residual. Tragedy soaked into the walls, but one of them, a man named Gavin, said it was more than that. It's feeding off you, he told George privately. The more you react, the more power it has. They set up tape recorders in the basement, kitchen, and attic. When they played them back later that night, George and Kathy listened in horror. The basement recording was static, then footsteps, then breathing, then a voice, raspy and low, get out or stay forever. Kathy began having waking visions. She'd be folding laundry and suddenly see herself drowning in the bathtub. She'd blink and be back in the hallway. Once, she looked down and saw her hands covered in blood. She screamed and dropped the laundry basket. When George came running, her hands were clean. The children weren't spared. Christopher had a nightmare so vivid he wet the bed, something he hadn't done in years. He said he saw George stabbing Kathy in the kitchen, over and over again. When Kathy asked Missy if she had nightmares too, the little girl just nodded and said, Jody told me you'll all die here. They packed bags that night, just in case. The final straw came one evening during a storm. The windows rattled, wind howled, the power cut out, the fire went cold. George raced to the basement to check the generator. He didn't come back. 10 minutes, then 15. Kathy grabbed a flashlight and headed down. She found him in the red room, on his knees, whispering to something she couldn't see. George, she shouted. He turned slowly. His eyes were pitch black. She screamed and ran. When George emerged minutes later, he was normal again, confused. He didn't remember going down there. That was the night they agreed. They couldn't stay another day. The next morning, they left the house. They didn't wait for explanations. They didn't tell the neighbors. They loaded the kids and the dog into the van, left the keys on the counter, and drove off. They never returned, not even to retrieve the furniture, the photos, or the journal. But the voices stayed, and anyone who listens closely, even now, can still hear them behind those peeling walls. Calling. Chapter 3. The Red Room. George Lutz had always thought of himself as a man of logic. He was a former Marine, calm, rational, a problem solver. But the basement of 112 Ocean Avenue stripped away every layer of that identity piece by piece. He first discovered the Red Room by accident, though later he questioned if it was really an accident at all. He had gone down to fix a breaker after another strange power outage. The basement was mostly unfinished, bare walls, concrete floors, the musty smell of old earth. But something caught his attention, a strange outline behind the wooden shelf in the corner. He moved the shelf aside, revealing a small door no taller than a child. It wasn't on the blueprints. There was no lock, just a handle. He opened it and stepped inside. The room was barely the size of a closet, cloaked in darkness even with a flashlight. But what struck George first was the smell, sharp, metallic, suffocating, like rust and blood. The walls were painted red, not crimson, not burgundy. Red, thick and saturated, as though the color had been soaked into the concrete, not applied. He stood frozen in the center, flashlight trembling in his hand. The air was dense, heavy, as if the room had been holding its breath for decades. Then the light flickered, and he heard it. Stay. One word, one whisper. He turned and left without looking back. George didn't tell Kathy about the Red Room right away. He wasn't sure why. Maybe part of him hoped it would vanish if ignored. But that night, he dreamt he was back in the room, walls pulsing like veins, the red paint oozing toward him. He couldn't move, couldn't breathe. When he awoke, his hands were stained red, not paint, not blood, something in between. He scrubbed his skin raw in the sink, but the stain didn't lift until midday. Finally, he told Kathy. She insisted on seeing it. Together, they descended the basement steps, past the water heater, past the stacked boxes of Christmas decorations. She hesitated at the door. This wasn't here before, George nodded. I know. They opened it together. Kathy gasped. It feels wrong in here. She backed out almost immediately. It's not a room, George. It's a wound. That night, the house made its displeasure known. The walls groaned. The lights dimmed and pulsed. Kathy's crucifix fell from the wall and shattered at her feet. And George, he changed, not gradually, not subtly. Overnight, he became cold, detached. He snapped at the kids, barked at Kathy, locked himself in the study for hours at a time. He stopped eating. One afternoon, Missy came downstairs with a note written in crayon. It read, "Daddy lives in the Red Room now." Kathy tore it in half. Determined to understand, she went back to the basement alone. The door to the Red Room was wide open. She stepped inside, holding a Bible in one hand, a flashlight in the other. The temperature dropped instantly. Her breath clouded in front of her. She opened the Bible and began to read aloud. "Yea, though I walk through the valley..." The light died, complete blackness. Then, voices, dozens of them, whispering, laughing, crying. Then a single booming voice echoed through the walls. "He is ours." Kathy screamed and fled, dropping the Bible behind her. That same night, Daniel, the eldest child, woke screaming. He claimed something was crawling on the ceiling of his room. George rushed in. There were scratches on the wall, deep ones, like claws. No one could explain it. The dog wouldn't go near the basement anymore. He whimpered every time someone approached the stairs. One night, he stood at the top, barking wildly, until George snapped and locked him outside. The next morning, they found the dog shivering, covered in scratches. The Red Room began appearing in their dreams. Kathy saw herself chained inside, begging George to save her while he stood motionless. Missy said Jody took her there at night and showed her bad things. George saw it as a throne room, only he was the one sitting on the throne, laughing while his family wept in front of him. Whatever the Red Room truly was, it had become the heart of the haunting. On the 23rd night, George returned to the room with a hammer and sledge. He was going to destroy it. He swung the hammer into the wall, and the house screamed. The floor buckled. Lights upstairs exploded. Every door in the house slammed shut at once. The children cried. Kathy shouted his name, but George kept swinging. He chipped the concrete. Again. Again. Finally, something gave way. Behind the wall. Another space. A crawl tunnel leading deeper under the house. He peered inside. Cobwebs. Dust. Bones. Small ones. He staggered back. Kathy called the priest again, begged him to return. He refused. He said the last time he entered that house, something followed him home. He had been sick ever since. His own church barred him from talking about it. He told Kathy only one thing, burn the house down. But they didn't. They stayed 5 more nights, each one worse than the last. George stopped sleeping altogether. He wandered the halls with an axe. The kids avoided him. Kathy feared he would hurt someone in his trance-like state. The red room was always open now, even when they locked it. Even when they boarded it up, it never stayed closed. On the 28th night, the house erupted. Blood poured from the walls. The staircase warped. The chandelier twisted itself loose and crashed into the floor. Doors opened and slammed with deafening force. Missy levitated again, screaming for Jody to make it stop. George snapped out of his trance long enough to grab her and run. Kathy grabbed the boys. They ran out barefoot into the snow, never looked back. The Red Room remains. No official investigation was ever launched. No bones were reported to authorities. The next tenants claimed they felt nothing strange, but they also stayed less than a year, and they never opened the basement. Chapter 4. Jody's Secret. When they first moved in, Kathy had dismissed Missy's imaginary friend as nothing more than a child's way of adjusting to a new home. Little kids often invented characters to process stress, she told herself. But Jody wasn't just an imaginary friend. Jody knew things Missy couldn't possibly know. She described places in the house she had never been allowed to go. She recited names that weren't part of their lives, names tied to the DiFio family, who had died there just the year before. And then there were her drawings. Missy began to sketch obsessively, crude images in crayon and pencil, figures with hollow faces, bleeding walls, a red room with claws reaching out. But the most chilling were the ones of Jody herself. Not a little girl, not a friendly spirit, but a giant black pig with glowing red eyes. Kathy found the first drawing under Missy's pillow.